From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Five years ago this month, protests erupted in Ferguson, Missouri. Frustration unleashed after the police shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown. The protests, marred by looting, lasted for days. And a week after Brown's death, then-Governor Jay Nixon moved to quell the unrest.
To protect the people and property of Ferguson today, I signed an order declaring a state of emergency and ordering the implementation of a curfew.
Riot police clashed with protesters. Here's one resident describing what he saw to the New York Times.
They started letting these go on us. Tear gas grenades.
Tear gas.
They threw about 20 tear gas grenades out at one time, and next thing you know, drove off at high speeds.
Yep.
What the hell is that about? There's kids out here tonight. That's ridiculous, man. Yep. We live in, it's like a third-class country here or something.
Yep.
The officer who killed Brown was not charged, but the U.S. Department of Justice, activists, and community leaders demanded that Ferguson changes the way it polices its streets. So how's that happened? This hour on Point, 5 years after Ferguson, a city's struggle, and the lessons for the national conversation about race and policing. And you can join us. What are your memories of the Ferguson protests 5 years ago? What, if anything, has changed where you live about race and policing? Join us online at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from St. Louis is Wesley Bell. He's the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney, and he previously represented Ward 3 on the Ferguson City Council. Wesley Bell, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us the story about where you were 5 years ago in August, when Michael Brown was killed and when the protests that followed erupted.
At that time, I was a professor at a local college in Ferguson. I headed the criminal justice department. I also was an attorney and just someone who was involved in my community and was particularly working with young people as an educator. And little did I know that my community would be making international news, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So tell us then about in the days and the weeks of the protests, what are the conversations that you were having with members of your community? What were people saying? I mean, put us back there.
You know, I think that I think first and foremost, few realize the scope of the issues that we were facing, not only in Ferguson, St. Louis County, Missouri, but across the nation. And I think that Ferguson was many would argue a ground zero, if you will, for addressing these and realizing that these issues were so broad in scope. And so at that time, as an attorney, I knew that some of these issues existed and worked in the courts that I worked in to address those issues. But, a lot of people, a lot of good people did a lot of good work, including President Obama's Department of Justice, to illuminate and shed light on the fact that this was a much larger problem. And what I'm really proud of is that once many realized this larger, not only regional but national issue, many stepped up to the plate, and I like to, and I'm proud to be in that category of a lot of people and organizations who in fact stepped up to the plate.
Right. So there was and continue to be a complex set of factors, historical, political, that led to this moment. Right. But there's still. Mm-hmm. There's lots of differing points of view around Michael Brown's actual death here. So I just want to get a quick call here. Phil is calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Phil, you're on the air.
Yeah, the name is Bill, but that's okay.
Sorry, Phil. Bill.
There was an article in the New York Times written by a lady who did a profile of the officer and Michael Brown. And right after that article came out, the outrage that came out from a lot of Ferguson residents was that it slandered Michael Brown. But no one at that time argued about the facts in that article. The facts are, among other things, that Michael Brown was very, very thuggish. That's it in a nutshell. He wasn't another Trayvon Martin. The facts are that he was definitely trying to do serious bodily injury to that officer or worse. Now, maybe there was a way of stopping Michael Brown. I don't know what that could have been. Hmm. I mean, short of the officer being crippled or choked to death, I think it was a case, clear case of self-defense.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you for your call. I'm going to let Wesley Bell respond to that. And Bill's talking about the facts of the case. I would say that the use of the word thuggish is a value judgment and not necessarily a fact, Bill. But to your bigger point about the complexities around the moment that led to Michael Brown's death. I mean, Wesley Bell, can you respond to that? Because there is still a great deal of disagreement here. How would you respond to Bill?
Well, first and foremost, I do want to push back on the idea, and I appreciate you for also pointing out, is that I think we need to get past the name calling.
Yeah.
None of us know exactly what happened, but what we do know is that that was a young man who lost his life. And at the very least, let's pay our respects and get away from the name calling. Mm-hmm. As far as particulars of the case, as a policy, but also ethically, I am not going to go into the details. I do believe that people have to understand whenever we deal with a situation where someone loses their life, every time that we bring it up, family members, friends, loved ones have to relive that situation all again. So what I would like to focus on is what comes out of that. What out of tragedy often comes opportunity. And as a result, we have an opportunity to address some much broader issues when we look at a lack of community policing prior to 2014. Mm. And still, we still have a ways to go. The cash bail system, the ways that courts were using people in their community as ATMs, we know that these things were happening. And so I think there's broader lessons that we can learn and issues that we can address.
Well, those broader issues that need addressing, I want to talk to you about. But there are people in Ferguson, namely Michael Brown's father, who they are not ready to move past that moment. They still feel, he feels that justice hasn't been served, right? Because Officer Darren Wilson, who was involved in the shooting, he was never charged. And Michael Brown Sr. urged your office, the St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office, to reopen the case into his son's death. And here he is speaking at a press conference on the fifth anniversary of Michael Brown's killing.
I am demanding evidence to be reanalyzed and accountability to follow. As a father, I value... As a father, I vow to protect my children. Well, on August 9th, 2014, that wasn't the case. I could not protect him that day, and it breaks my heart. I will stand and fight until the day I die for justice.
That's Michael Brown Sr. Urging Wesley Bell's office, Wesley Bell's the prosecuting attorney for St. Louis County, to reopen the case into Michael Brown's death. I mean, will you?
Well, first and foremost, I have a lot of respect for the parents, Michael Brown Sr., as well as Leslie McSpadden. I've had conversations with Mr. Brown Sr. and that go back years at this point. And those conversations were private and they'll remain mm-hmm. so. I will tell you things that we are doing in our office, and one is we are creating a conviction incident and review unit that will not only look at cases that have legitimate allegations of wrongful convictions, but also older cases can be reviewed. We are in the process of establishing that unit. But with respect to any particular cases, I'm not going to go into any details. And let's keep in mind, this is still a very much a sore spot and an open wound for this region. And I think it irresponsible for me to pull that scab prior to any decisions being made, if there are going to be some decisions made. So I'll just say it like this. I don't have any comment until and if I ever do have a comment.
Well, as a prosecutor, though, you understand that questions need to be asked. So I'm going to just ask you a couple, quick more questions about this. Feel free to not respond, but do you think justice has been served in the case of Michael Brown's death?
So I've been in office 7 months, and this is the largest, and I have the largest county in Missouri, close to 1 million people. And we have an office that deals with a lot of serious crimes. And so our focus has been on that transition, getting this office up and running as well, or not up and running, but continued to be running efficiently and still dealing with cases that are still coming in. So at this point, I have not had any opportunities to review any older cases. And and so that's where we are at this point.
Okay, so we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break. But looking forward, then, what do you think it would take for justice to be done in this case? What does justice look like to you?
I think, and I hate to sound evasive because that's not what I'm doing here. But what I'm trying to explain is that we are dealing with cases that are coming to this office now. Prior cases, if we get to a point where it's time to look at them, we'll do that. But at this point, we are making sure to keep focusing on our mission to keep St. Louis County residents safe. And that includes that entails the cases that we're dealing with now.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk more about those big systemic issues that Ferguson also revealed and see how far Ferguson and St. Louis County have come on those. So Wesley Bell, stand by here for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about 5 years after Ferguson and the death of Michael Brown and the protests that followed in Ferguson and the catalyst that it was to really shine a new bright light on race and policing in this country. So we want to know what you think, what your questions are. Well, the officer who was involved in Michael Brown's death, who shot him, Officer Darren Wilson, has maintained that it was an act of self-defense. In November 2014, in an interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos, Wilson said that he was following his training when he ended up shooting Brown.
So you go through the checklist, the mental checklist, you rule out mace.
Yes.
This is all happening in a split second.
Yes. And the only thing option I left was my firearm.
That's Officer Darren Wilson speaking to George Stephanopoulos in 2014. Well, Michael Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden Head, has been a vocal proponent of increased police accountability. Here she is in a 2018 interview.
Everybody's capable of having a bad day. Everybody's capable of making a mistake. But you have to own up to it. You have to be responsible for what you do. And we see a lack of responsibility when it comes to some law enforcement being held accountable for their actions.
We're joined today by Wesley Bell. He's prosecuting attorney for St. Louis County. He previously served on the Ferguson City Council. He's with us from St. Louis. And also now joining us is Fran Griffin, with us from St. Louis, Missouri. She's a city council member for Ferguson's 3rd Ward. That's the ward in which Michael Brown was killed. She's also a member of the Ferguson Collaborative, a group of community members advocating for community input and accountability into the U.S. Department of Justice consent decree that was written regarding policing in Ferguson. Fran Griffin, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, give us your take here. How far along regarding the sort of big systemic issues that were revealed by what happened in Ferguson? How far along has Ferguson come from that in 5 years?
We've made some improvements, but we definitely have. We are not finished yet. We are still in the implementation process of the policies that have so far been revised. We've got a few things that are still on the list to be completed, but I'm feeling positive that we will continue to work on those to get those accomplished.
So specifically what?
So as of right now, we've revised the use of force policy, stop, search, and arrest, accountability, neighborhood policing. This was done in conjunction with the Ferguson Police Department and the Department of Justice, but it was also done with a group of community advocates and residents within the NPSC, which is the Neighborhood Policing Steering Committee. Those policies, once revised, once we go through the process, then the officers have to get trained on those. They have to do so many hours of training. And so that specifically is one of the things that we're in the process of actually implementing the training on now.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you've obviously been a key part of the Ferguson community for a long time. How different is what you're describing from what was common practice 5 years ago?
How different is it?
Yeah.
So there's a difference. If you ask the people who have been revising policies, they will have one specific answer for you. You'll be like, you know, we've come a long way because we've actually been able to change things in black and white. But in terms of the greater community, the community that feels the impact of these policies being revised, I would have to say that they have yet to feel that because those policies need to be trained. The officers have to be trained, and then they go out into the community. So depending on who it is that you speak to, you will get different answers.
I see. I'm seeing here that there are some meaningful, very meaningful steps forward taken in Ferguson, right? I mean, you're a member of the city council. Back in 2014, there was only one African-American on the city council. Now there are, what, six? Is that right?
Well, you have Ella Jones, who is the councilwoman in the first ward. You have Toni Burrows, who is a councilwoman in the second ward. You have myself, and you have Byron Fry, who was appointed after Wesley Bell won the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney's elected position, and he's in the third ward.
Right. So a difference there then in representation. I'm also seeing that the police department, who at the time of Michael Brown's death only had three African-American officers, now about half of them are black. Jason Armstrong, the chief of police of Ferguson, is African-American. I mean, Wesley Bell, are these meaningful differences that go towards changing the deeper issues that you were talking about that led to what happened 5 years ago?
Well, as many know, myself and Fran were big advocates for neighborhood and community policing. And one component of that is having people in the community who reflect the community. And so having more African Americans on the police department by itself is not going to be a panacea. Mm-hmm. It has to be coupled with policies to make certain that people are treated fairly, that people's rights are not abused. But having said that, it is a step in the direction. And sometimes I think we miss the bigger picture when we talk about diversity, and we think that, well, diversity for the sake of diversity is a good thing. No, diversity, you still don't want to compromise bringing quality people, experienced people who are connected to the community. But when you're sitting in those tables and at those tables where decisions are made, and Fran is in that situation now, it's good to have different perspectives at the table, because what was happening prior to myself and Fran and others coming on the council is that you did not get the voice from many of these disenfranchised communities to say, hey, wait, there's another way to look at this, at this problem. And so overall, we're heading in the right direction. But I agree with Fran, there's still a lot more to do.
Mm. And so, Fran, I mean, where are the next places that you would focus efforts in Ferguson?
So as of right now, we need to do, I believe in not only working on the progression of the consent decree, but it's really important that we as a community build from grassroots efforts. That means block captains. That means getting streets organized. That means getting neighborhood associations established throughout the city of Ferguson, which mm-hmm. we have a lot that are already developed, but we need more specifically in areas where there are disenfranchised marginalized people. And so, that's something that is going to be ongoing regardless. Also, the implementation, making sure that the Department of Justice and the Ferguson Police Department are laying out the framework for what the policies, the training of those policies looks like, making it transparent so that the community is aware. And moving forward in that manner, we have a civilian review board. We have cases that need to be reviewed, and we have an opportunity to actually go through that process and see what that looks like, so that we can always find areas where improvement is necessary and work on those to make them better.
Now, Fran, forgive me if you said this a few minutes ago, but I just want to be clear. Are there certain basic things that have yet to be accomplished with the Ferguson Police Department? For example, I mean, are they yet collecting data on police use of force?
So the thing about the data was that the system that was used through the city of Ferguson needed to be, they were technically speaking, using two different data collection systems. So that was something that the monitor has talked about. That's something that they're actively working on now, actually getting to a point where they've got a data system where they can collect all of the information that they need to perform different audits, to perform different analysis. And so that's something that they're working on now, and it will be completed. They're actually expecting for it to be completed within this next I would say within the next few quarters, because we meet quarterly in front of the federal status judge. Excuse me.
Okay. And Wesley Bell, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah. And as I was there during the negotiations with President Obama's Department of Justice, I know that it is a large effort. And it's going to take a lot of work to get these things done. And I know that Fran and other members of the council who are very invested in this, particularly Fran, Ellen, and others, are really working to get that. But we have to keep in mind, this is a small city, 21,000 people with limited budgets. And so, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and all of these things aren't going to be implemented in a day. However, we do want to make sure that there's a good faith effort to continue to push in the right direction and not drag our feet. And that's why I'm glad people like Councilman Griffin are there, who will make sure that people are held accountable. But there's just more to do. And, you know, and I'll even use this, and Fran probably wouldn't bring this up because she's so classy, but I will, since I'm not there. You know, just small things, understanding that I was the council member in Ward 3 as well as Fran. And this is the area that has been the most disenfranchised, the poorest economically challenged area. And small things to help beautify this community sometimes get resistance. For example, myself, Ella, Fran have worked hard to get a particular park there, because there's not a lot of places for children to play in that area. And that's something that has, for some reason, has been a point of contention with many that shouldn't be. We're not talking a lot of money. Most of it has been provided through grants. Mm. But I think that's an analogy, a metaphor for a larger a larger problem of ignoring these areas that need the most attention. The worst streets are in Ward 3, the lack of parks and places for kids to play. And that's why I'm glad we have some council members who are pushing for that.
Yeah. Well, Fran Griffin, if I may, I should have asked you the questions that I asked Wesley Bell when we started this show, because I'd love to hear from you where you were and what you experienced in the days after Michael Brown was killed. Where were you?
At the time, I was living exactly where I'm living now. Mm-hmm. I was a mother. I am a mother. I was working for a facility in the city that saw over 95% Medicaid patients from the time that they grew in their first tooth to the time that they turned 19. And so I was working. Yeah. And when Mike Brown Jr. was killed, I came outside. I attended the vigils with my children. And while there, while being amongst my community, watching people, you know, just mourning the loss of a child within the community, I was met with aggressive tactics from our police department, not just the city of Ferguson, but St. Louis County as well. And
aggressive tactics meaning what?
Riot gear. In a time where we were using our constitutional rights to march, that was what, you know, we were doing at the time. And we were met with riot gear. We were met with guns pointed at us. And at the time, I had my children with me. My daughter, my youngest child, who was 7 at the time, was so afraid that she broke from my hands to get away from, to get to safety. And for me, that was very impactful, because I had taught my daughter, you know, if she was ever afraid, if she was ever lost, you know, to go up to a police officer, give them your name, give them your parents' name, your telephone number. And for her in that space, her reality was I was not doing anything. And the police were shooting at a community of people who were, you know, who were mourning the loss of another child within our community. Yeah. And from that point on, it told me that I had to be outside. So literally for every day, I would go to work, come home, feed my babies, change my clothes, and I would be outside in the streets with my people. And what I found was that there was a lot of us in the community who had the same experiences. You know, we were dealing with the same things, and we were learning on the ground, you know, who the local politicians were, you know, what powers they had, what, you know, who it was that controlled, what's the purpose of a city manager, and all of that was learned. Mm-hmm. And so we just started attending city council meetings and getting more and more involved.
So can I interject?
Go ahead.
Is it okay if I interject?
Sure.
Just want to, to Fran's point, I want to illustrate why neighborhood policing is so important, because sometimes we hear the term and it can get kind of brushed under the rug as a cliche. And I think that's the perfect example. And this goes back to the previous caller. And what we have to understand is that what Ferguson and many police departments were doing, we're not getting involved and getting to know members of their community. And what that begets is a lack of trust, a lack of credibility. So when a situation happens with an officer, there was no one that was willing to step up and say, you know what, I know that officer. I know him, so, you know, and I trust him. So let's see what the facts are before we make a rush to judgment. That wasn't happening because officers were not getting out of the cars and getting to know people. And that's why community policing is so important. I know some officers now that if they were ever accused of something, there would be a lot of people who would step up and say, hold on, I know this individual. Let's hear their side of the story first. But this wasn't happening in Ferguson. Officers weren't getting out of their cars, getting to know people. And and that's the reason that there was no one in our community that was going to step up and say, you know what, Mr. Wilson is a good guy. No one said that because no one knew him. And I think that's a that's an example of a larger issue that needs to be addressed in addition to what happened on that fateful day.
Well, Fran, we have about 30 seconds before we have to take another break here. But just let me ask you briefly, has trust been restored in any meaningful way between the community and law enforcement in Ferguson?
I would say no. That's a long term. That's something that's going to happen over time.
Okay. Well, Fran Griffin is city council member for Ferguson's 3rd Ward, the ward where Michael Brown was killed. She joins us today from St. Louis, Missouri. Wesley Bell is also with us, also from St. Louis. He's the prosecuting attorney for St. Louis County. And we are talking about Ferguson 5 years later and the impact that it also has had on the national conversation regarding race and policing. We'll take a look at that national level picture in more detail when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about 5 years after Ferguson. Want to hear your thoughts on how Michael Brown's death and the protests that followed in Ferguson, Missouri 5 years ago, how they changed the national conversation on policing and race in this country. I'm joined today by Fran Griffin. She's a city council member for Ferguson's 3rd Ward. She joins us from St. Louis. Wesley Bell is also with us. He's the prosecuting attorney for St. Louis County, with us from St. Louis as well. And joining us now from Washington is Jeff Pegues. He's CBS News Justice and Homeland Security correspondent. He reported on changes in policing nationwide in the aftermath of Ferguson for a special series for CBS that's out this month. He's also author of Black and Blue, Inside the Divide Between Police, the Police and Black America. Jeff, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hello.
So first of all, tell us, I mean, what did you observe? You were reporting on the DOJ at the time of Michael Brown's killing. I mean, what were the sort of the biggest issues that came to light as a result of what happened in Ferguson?
You know, there are so many, but I'll start with how cell phone cameras introduce this vivid picture of police community relations and use of force. I think that was the pivotal evidence, if you will, that we saw across the country that really opened people's eyes. You know, the black community, of course, has been talking about these things for decades, but a broader audience now saw what was happening, and there were many people who hadn't seen this before who were certainly alarmed. And others who were obviously aware became more energized. And I think cell phone cameras really changed the narrative around this issue and forced police departments in cities across the country to grapple with it, to acknowledge that there are problems. And I think that is the real legacy of Ferguson. But also you had Eric Garner, you had mm-hmm. Freddie Gray, you had Alton,
go ahead.
Alton Sterling,
yeah.
Excuse me, Philando Castile. You had these very, these huge cases, and the video evidence was there, and I think that's what surprised a lot of people.
So, I mean, you've been reporting about how police departments across the country, to a certain degree, underwent a certain degree of self-examination. Like, what kind of changes did they try to implement?
Well, you had to become more transparent. I mean, these are police departments across the country, big and small. They were forced to become more transparent. When they had these use of force incidents, they were forced to go public with a lot of the information that in the past they would not have gone public with, and they would have said, well, we want to protect the integrity of the investigation. However, now you're seeing police departments who have to be more transparent. You have police officers wearing body cameras. That is supposed to increase the transparency. So there have been these changes that have forced police departments across this country to reveal more about their interactions with community members, smaller interactions, and then the more high-profile use of force incidents. So it has really forced these departments to become more transparent.
So Jeff, but to that point, though, not everywhere. I mean, full disclosure, I'm sitting in a studio in Boston, Massachusetts, and their process of getting body cams on police officers has been incredibly fraught. There was a lot of pushback from the police department about even a pilot program around body cams. So I don't think there's... I mean, I'm not questioning your reporting, but I'm saying that I don't think there's been this, like, overwhelming wave of transparency coming out of law enforcement.
Well, but that – and you bring up a good point about body cameras. Yes, not every single department. There are 18,000 police departments across this country, essentially. So, yeah, not – every single police department has embraced body cameras, but the majority of the major police departments, yes, they've had to embrace body cameras. And what we found is that officers who did not like the idea of body cameras, now in many cases they see them as a positive because the body cameras actually clear the good cops of wrongdoing, right? And so you have the majority of police departments, they have introduced these body cameras. There are some that are reluctant to do so, but the majority have introduced body cameras are working toward that goal.
Okay. Fran and Wesley, I'm going to come back to you in just a second. But Jeff, in your reporting, you talked about how many police departments underwent or had their officers undergo things like implicit bias training. Has that proven effective?
Well, and that is what we found in this year-long investigation. We crisscrossed the country talking to big and smaller departments across the country, and implicit bias training, as you know, was something that was introduced post-Ferguson by the Obama administration. It came out of the 21st Century Policing Task Force that the Obama administration led. But what we found is that there's no real measure that this implicit bias training is working. In fact, we talked to rank-and-file police officers in Mesa, Arizona, which is a department that is, you know, I think by all accounts, you know, if you look at the high-profile incidents there, it is a troubled police department. But we talked to rank-and-file officers there who told us that they thought that implicit bias training was just a big show and was not helping the situation. And it was part of somebody's agenda, and it made all-white police officers look as if they are racist. So they did not like implicit bias training. We also went to St. Louis Metro PD in the city of St. Louis, and we talked to officers there who say they don't even remember taking implicit bias training, even though the police department officials told us that it is mandatory for them to take it. So that is one aspect of the training, really, that has, you know, there are questions about whether it's really making a difference.
Well, Wesley Bell, would you like to respond to what Jeff has found in his reporting?
I agree. I think that, and I would just add the caveat that what we know is that with many of these trainings, it depends on the commitment from the department, often top down. If a chief insists and makes it really mandatory that people not only take these trainings, but embrace these trainings, and they're evaluated based on these types of trainings, you'll see more of a positive impact with things like implicit bias. But if it's just sit in front of the computer and get your hours in, then yeah, you're right. You're not going to get the type of impact that we would want to get. And so with the 18,000 police departments in the country, there's no way to measure who is actually taking this seriously and who isn't. And so that's going to be a hard thing to measure. Yeah. But I think the fact that we're seeing more of it is a positive. But we have to make sure that our leadership in law enforcement understands how important these types yeah. of trainings are.
Let's go to a quick call. Derek is calling from Waterbury, Connecticut. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi. I feel that a lot of it has to do with the law. The law allows the need to use deadly force is so lax that even me, I feel like I'm the Michael Ferguson. I'm that person that's most likely to be pulled over and asked for my registrations and license, and I reached my back pocket to get my license, and I can be shot just that easy because the law allows them to say, I thought he was reaching for a gun. And another man running with his back turned, and he's getting shot in the back with his back to him. The law allows that. And we chase the police officers. He's only doing what the law allows him to do mm-hmm. when he can do it because his training. And it's just like back in the slavery days when they turned the dogs loose on the runaway slave. It wasn't illegal for him to do that. And right. nor is it illegal right now for them to shoot us.
Derek, thank you so much for your call. Wesley Bell, let me turn back to you on that because I guess what Derek is pointing to the fact that officers can frequently state that in the moment their safety was at risk, and that's one of the reasons why whatever the incident is happened, and very very often that's enough for a court or prosecutors to decide not to bring charges. So does that need to change? Can it?
Well, it's a little bit more complex, okay. and there's a yeah. caveat to it, is that any laws have to be in compliance with Tennessee versus Garner, which is the Supreme Court's ruling on an officer's use of force. So states cannot just write any laws that they want with respect to use of force. They have to be in compliance. And the fact is that if an officer believes that his safety is in danger, he or she can use deadly force. Now, here's where training and body cameras come into play, because if there is no one there and it's just not even he say, she say, or he say, because oftentimes the assailant is deceased as a result of a shooting. Well, that's where body cameras come in the play, because now we have a better idea of what happened. We can see what happened as opposed to just relying on someone's testimony. And also that's where training comes into play, is that when officers understand that, hey, you know, the implicit bias, cultural sensitivity, but also de-escalation, you're going to see less of these situations. So I think the more resources that we put into law enforcement that are actually effective, the less we'll see of these types of issues. And then it comes down last, I'll say, to recruiting. We got to recruit more people who are more committed to their community, understand that just because someone is different or whatever their views may be, that that those trainings, those types of individuals need to be involved in different types of people need to be involved in law enforcement that won't just.
Yeah.
resort to shooting people.
Well, Fran Griffin, look, we've got a couple of minutes left in the show here. And of course, we've been focusing a lot on policing itself. But it's not just an issue of law enforcement, right? It's not just an issue of the use of force. There were a whole complex variety of challenges that Ferguson faced that led to that moment. I mean, beyond police, what are the supports? What work still needs to be done in the community at large?
So as of right now, we need to do a lot of organizing amongst the neighborhoods. We have to find ways to constantly include the residents of the community into the decision-making process, whether that means getting more folks on boards and commissions, whether that means getting them to take the opportunity to have a voice in who it is that we select as the police chief. Also having other coming up with new ways for the community to get involved in terms of who it is that we have in these positions that are able to maneuver and make decisions on our behalf that are supposed to represent us, getting involved locally into local politics and understanding what those dynamics are and understanding what we're working towards and getting more people in the community involved in that process as well. All of that adds to community empowerment. All of that helps change the dynamics of a system that was originally created, established, and run by people who a small amount of people and not representing a large majority of the people that lived in the neighborhood.
Have things like, African-Americans being disproportionately pulled over or fined, Wesley Bell mentioned earlier that the county sort of just relied on the income from that to support the county. I mean, have things like that changed? Or are we still seeing African Americans being disproportionately targeted?
I think we have some challenges. I'm not sure if you're aware, but we have an interim city manager that was cited in the DOJ investigations as encouraging the police department to increase fines and fees, who believes that the main thing we should be doing is compliance, not taking into consideration the fact that there are several people within our community that simply can't afford to do some of the things that they're asking to be to comply with. Mm-hmm. And so I think this process is very important because, one, yes, we should be abiding by the law. However, we need to look at these ordinances. We need to look at things that impact specifically, which is a requirement within the consent decree, that impact specifically marginalized communities, people of who don't have the finances to be able to take care of stuff, to be able to, you know, I'm going to give you a perfect example. Like me, for instance, my lawnmower went out. I didn't have the finances to be able to get it fixed. In the meanwhile, I'm getting notices that my grass is tall. So if we've got ordinances that's saying that, hey, you can't have grass above a certain level, but then you don't have the income to be able to address the problem. It's not that you don't want to. You just simply don't have the income to be able to address the problems. Then what ends up happening is that whole rotation of generating fees based off of, you know, ordinances that are put in place that specifically affect people who do not have the funds to be able to address them.
Yeah. So, Wesley Bell, we've got a minute left to go. And I'm so grateful that Fran gave us that example there, because doesn't that get to the heart of the matter? That there are like really deeper issues here that power the cycle that power the cycle that led to what happened 5 years ago. And have we made any meaningful progress in getting to those really deeper issues?
You know, I think, again, if we expect something that has an issue that has we have been struggling with since the beginning of this country to end in five years, we're misguided. The idea, though, is to start addressing these issues systemically. The policies that we've implemented in our office are directly at doing that. Examples being getting rid of the cash bail system, as well as expanding diversion programs to give individuals who need treatment that help so that they can avoid the void incarceration. But to Fran's point, exactly, that's also something that needs to be addressed. Some people they don't have the finances, and we got to work with them and give them opportunities to be able to address these issues.
Well, with that, I've got to go, and I'd like to thank all my guests, Wesley Bell, Fran Griffin, and Jeff Pagaz. Thank you all so much for joining us today. This is On Point.